Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is Simon Lambert for an end-of-year wrap-up. We'll run the rule over the government's financial efforts this year, the good, the bad, and the frozen, plus the state of the economy. Interest rates continued to fall, inflation proved sticky, and growth, well, has been pretty underwhelming. Better news for mortgage holders, but the property market remained sluggish. Not like the FTSE, it's been a knockout year against the backdrop of an impending AI crash. Plus, another big compensation scandal rumbled on. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a message from our sponsors. You've spent Christmas giving to others. Well, why don't you give yourself a gift? The gift of financial clarity with support from Charles Stanley Direct's Financial Coaching. Led by This Is Money regular Lisa Kaplan, Financial Coaching gives you access to a real expert who can help you make sense of your financial plans. Book your free 15-minute call today at charles-stanley.co.uk/financial-coaching. Go on, get answers you can trust. And remember, investment involves risk. Now back to the show. From a £40 billion tax package last autumn, billed as a one-and-done, to winter fuel and IHT U-turns after pensioner and farmer backlashes and another tax-raising budget, albeit more stealthily, this was a year where fiscal discipline repeatedly collided with political reality. And politics usually won. Simon, very briefly, if you were to assess, teacher-esque, the government's financial performance this year, what grade would you give them? And let's just stick to the old school. I don't understand this like 9, 8, 7 GCSE thing going on. A, B, C, D, F.
As someone whose eldest daughter has just started her GCSEs and will therefore be numbered, I also have no idea what the numbers mean.
I thought you were going to say you're an expert in it.
My favourite thing about this is that actually it directly relates to what you're talking about, which is I do not understand why in this country we insist on making our lives harder than they need to be. The GCSEs are now graded by numbers. The way they explain those numbers is by referring to them as it's like an A or it's like a B. They refer to them as like the old system. So we've introduced a completely new system that hardly anybody understands, especially those people who aren't actually at school at the time. And then we explain it by reference to the old system. The old system was totally fine. I mean, the old system was better before they started adding like random A stars above A, and you could get A star, 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 stars.
But yeah, it's like League One, League Two, League Three, League Four. Why do you have to go, you know, Championship, Premier League? Just 1, 2, 3 works. It works.
There's a great saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly.
There is another saying that we should adopt in this country, which is if it is broke, do fix it. Unfortunately, to go back to your original question, we appear to have adopted that if it ain't broke, fix it. And if it is broke, just leave it and let it get slightly worse or patch it up. And I will refer you back to one of my pet peeves, the fact that our roads are completely falling apart. You can listen to councils and the government blame that on, you know, the harsh British weather. But I've been to hot countries. I've been to really cold countries and the roads are much better. Literally no excuse. Literally no. And they are awful at the moment. Absolutely unbelievable. But go back to the government's economic performance rather than the... And we can't blame this government for all of that stuff. We've been making these mistakes for years.
Do you know what? I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, Rachel Reeves. I'm really sorry, Keir Starmer. I think that you are trying. So I'd give you a higher mark for effort than I would for achievement. But on achievement, it's a D.
It's a pass, you know, though, isn't it?
Is it? I thought it was a C and above is what counts, isn't it?
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay. Apologies to anybody listening who's at school and feels disheartened by that, but you won't know what I'm talking about because you're numbered now anyway. No, it's a D. And that's, I think, being generous. I think the problem we have at the moment is the new government that came in last year.
Yep.
It was 2024. Summer. It feels longer, yep, doesn't it?
Summer. Oh, yeah.
It's no longer. Promised growth, promised not to raise a number of taxes, one of which
arguably it has raised national insurance, employers' national insurance, not employees' national insurance, but it is paid on people's wages. It does affect employees, and it's led to lots of job cuts as well, and businesses saying that it's causing the problems and saying that saying it's an anti-growth measure. There have been other things introduced that are anti-growth. It hasn't delivered the growth that it promised. It didn't come to power with any real plan to get that going in the short term. It just thought that a change of government and being, you know, more competent than the last lot and saying that it was going to build lots of houses would be enough. And it turns out that actually that's harder than you think. And that maybe they aren't more competent. Well, they probably are more competent than the last lot. But even then, you're looking at it and going, are they really? So I don't think any of the growth stuff has come through. I think some of the things they've done has been negative for growth. And don't listen to me, listen to businesses. And I think the problem is Labour is not listening to businesses. I want Rachel Reeves to do well. I want Keir Starmer to do well because I want the country to do well. And I'm fed up of being stuck in the rut that we're in. But just look at what's going on with pubs at the moment. Pubs have turned around since the budget and said, you've absolutely screwed us here. You told us you were going to help us out. You've actually caused us a massive problem. To the point where they're now barring, you know, all members of the not all members, they're barring Labour MPs, right, from their pubs. They're putting up signs and things like that. And they're just ploughing on regardless, going, no. Actually, we've delivered them a good deal. And it's like, you haven't. You did not deliver them a good deal. There's a reason why they're saying this. You've got to pay attention. And we've just had them finally pay attention to something that happened over a year ago with the farmers and inheritance tax, where they've gone, oh, okay, all right, we'll put it up to 2.5 million then. It's like the massive backlash from farmers. Oh, well, they're just grumbling. Oh, no, it's fine. We've delivered them a very fair system. It's like, you haven't. What you're trying to do is crack down on really, really rich people just buying land to dodge inheritance tax. And you could have created a system to do that. What you've actually done is created a system that massively disadvantages farmers and still gives those really rich people a bit of a benefit anyway. So there isn't really an incentive for them to stop doing it. And then farmers obviously got very upset about this and they just continued on going, no, you've nothing to complain about. We've given you a fair system. And so I think that, you know, there's a failure there. And then I think, so on the growth stuff, they haven't delivered. And they aren't really listening. And then on the other end of the scale, on the clamping down on spending, which is something else that we need to do in order to balance the books, that has obviously not really materialized either. There's been a number of high-profile U-turns. And I think some of those high-profile U-turns have come off the back of rushing things out when they didn't need to rush things out. Winter fuel, for example, the welfare reforms, which looked like they were desperately bashed together in order to try to hit the numbers in the spring statement. And unfortunately, it doesn't look great. And then the house building stuff, they're not going to hit the 1.5 million homes target. But again, I think this illustrates an example of not listening, because the reason why we aren't going to hit the 1.5 million homes target is not because we need to rip up all the planning rules so that people can just build stuff wherever the hell they want. The reason why we aren't going to meet the 1.5 million homes target is because developers aren't building homes because they can't sell them. People don't want to buy them. We talked about this on the podcast last week and the week before. It's like at the moment there's a new build crash going on where you can get massive discounts on new build homes because developers can't sell them. There isn't the demand for them because people can't afford them. Because they're sold as premium products and people are already struggling to buy anyway because they're feeling the pinch and mortgage rates are higher than they used to be and so on and so on. And yet we just keep bashing our head against this wall going, build 1.5 million homes, build 1.5 million homes.
There's a lot in there, Simon. There's a lot in there. But what sort of sticks out to me is, let's stick with the sort of school theme. And I remember a teacher once said to me, a bit of advice for exams was, go through it slowly rather than rush through and then return to it at the end. Because you're much more likely to get the right answer if you really focus on the question and then go with your initial instinct with it. Now, I don't know about the initial instinct, but certainly slow it down. And it feels to me that since they've come in, the government, And I agree with you 100%. We all want them to do well. Absolutely. You know, they came in on the crest of positivity. And this is where we go into your theory on miserabilism. We did immediately get, we're all in a big, dark, black hole. We must tax, but don't worry, it's a one and done. And that's continued. And I just don't understand. Why did we have to go at such breakneck speed when you will, of course, get U-turns on things like winter fuel, inheritance tax, benefit bill, which, you know, can't seem to get through? Makes you wonder sort of almost as well, who's in charge with some of this? If they can't just get a policy, get it through, they've had 14 years to think about this. And I think some of the measures as well, things like the mansion tax, which we said is not even a rounding error how much money that they will take in from it. It seeps down to people, even people who will never pay it, a bit like inheritance tax. It's one of those things that people go, it's not fair. It's anti-ambition. Even though, like I said, they will never pay that tax. And I think this is seeping into the country and creating a really, really bad vibe. And I'm not sure, and this is a podcast about 2025, I'm not sure what you do for 2026 when you think we've had a £40 billion tax package last year, £26 billion this year, and then the OBR says it's going to do nothing for growth. What on earth are we doing it for is the question that people are asking. Yeah, don't ask me. Ask people in the street. Ask businesses. I don't know what you do in that regard.
I agree with you. And I think that one of the mistakes that was made again, the miserabilism stuff, was we did the miserabilism thing again. Twice. We did it last year and it didn't work last year. And then we did it, Rachel Reeves did it this year again, with the build-up to the budget and that mad speech that she did, only to then do a U-turn on raising income tax. And actually, arguably, Rachel Reeves, look, I don't want to pay more tax. I pay lots of it already, okay? But arguably, Rachel Reeves should have raised income tax. That is, by economists were widely agreed that it was probably the best thing to do. If you've got to do it, just do that. Not lots of little bits of snipping around the edges, which creates the opportunity to cause problems. It skews things. You tinker here, you tinker there. It pushes a bit out over there, it pushes a bit out over there. Just, you know, the broadest tax pretty much everybody pays, and you have to listen to what's being said about the fact that, unfortunately, the basic rate needs to go up. You can't just put it up on higher rate payers because they're already paying a huge amount. The basic rate needs to go up. And you explain to people, look, you've actually already had a tax cut. The Tories took 4p off national insurance at the lower level. That's the equivalent of that. National insurance is an income tax. Mm. It's not income tax, but it is an income tax. So people had a 4p cut in the tax that they pay on their income. And you just say to people, we couldn't afford to do that. Couldn't afford to do the first one. We definitely couldn't afford to do the second one. We're going to have to take some of it back, but you're still in a better position in terms of the taxes on your income than you were 2.5 years ago. Well, and because we're doing this, we're not going to do all these other things because we've realized that that is a mistake, and it was a mistake by us, and it was a mistake by our predecessors. And you just move on. But you listen to people. And to go back to the inheritance tax point, I've said this for years. Inheritance tax somehow manages to be like the most hated tax in the UK, despite the fact that hardly anybody pays it. Lots more people are going to pay it in future due to the pension raid. It's going to go up to 1 in 10 from 1 in 5. And I suspect it will actually go up quite a lot higher than 1 in 10. And unfortunately, those people who do pay it can end up paying hundreds of thousands of pounds. And we're not talking about rich people here. We're talking about people in the kind of, you know, they're affluent by all measures, but we're not talking about the super rich people. But everybody hates it. And it's like, if there's a scenario where you've got a tax that hardly anybody pays, but is the most unpopular, not everybody hates it, but lots of people hate it. It's the most unpopular, regularly found to be the most unpopular. Maybe you should just get rid of it or do something about it in a way that means that all of a sudden it just, its unpopularity just like decreases. You revive its image. Basically, you give it a rebrand. You make it completely different or much less, you know, hit people less harder or whatever you do, right? Because it's damaging your tax system. It's damaging you. And so you listen to people. And if people are complaining about all these other little things, then you just go, oh, do you know what? You listen to them. If pubs, landlords are saying, okay, we're just going to, like, we're already at the point where we're going to have to shut. We're going to have to shut. This is absolutely terrible for us. You listen to them. If farmers are saying, you know, we're not making any money at all, you've totally failed, and the government failed to deliver on what you said you'd deliver when we left the EU and replacing the payments. We've had the worst harvest in, you know, however many years. Just watch Clarkson's Farm, for example. You know, like, and we can't do this. We're not doing this to make money. Yes, we look like we're worth lots of money on paper, but, you know, it's a business that gets passed down the generations. You don't want to be the person who gives up the family farm, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So just listen to them. And there's a difference between listening to people and the, you know, general population and listening to the most vocal people. Those with an axe to grind, or those with the vested interest, or the sort of playing to the crowd element. And I think the problem is at the moment there's a lot of the latter and not a lot of the former. There's too much listening to the most vocal kind of playing to the crowd elements and not enough listening to people in general, and it creates a toxic environment which also opens the doors to stuff becoming way more toxic.
Yeah, I mean, it, going back to the inheritance tax thing, it returns to something you said right at the start. If something's broken, fix it. And if it's, as the IFS said in a report just before the budget, at least don't make it a lot worse by making it more complicated. And this is the problem, is the system, the tax system is far too complicated. There are decisions being made that... law of unintended consequences, people talking about rich people leaving, so you may not get the money that you hoped for anyway. It is just a mess.
I would agree. And I would say that my major disappointment is that I always thought that when Labour came to power and Rachel Reeves became Chancellor, there was like the opportunity to do blank slate, to go, right, it's not working. Mm-hmm. We're going to change things. And you don't have to say, and also this is the other thing I think we should do. So to go with a kind of don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. I think we need to identify where we want to get to. And we then need to sell that vision to the public and say, look, okay, yeah, people aren't happy, but we live in a great country. We live in a country where we have freedoms, where we have protection of our freedoms, where we have protection of our property rights, where we're a democracy. You know, we've got this government because you voted it in. We have an orderly transition of governments, you know, all those other things. We live in an amazing country, a country that is so good that, you know, people from all around the world are traveling to try and live here. And it's not because we're a soft touch. Okay. It isn't because we're a soft touch. Some of it is because of the English language. But it is because people want to live in Britain. They see it as like, they're like, okay, in the list of countries that I want to live in, Britain is absolutely near the top or at the top. So that in itself says a good thing, but we're not in a great place. But this is where we want to get to. We know you're not happy on this. We know you're not happy on that. But like with the tax and the economy thing, we say, okay, this is the path. This is how we're going to get there. But it takes time. So, for example, with the tax system, you go, it's a mess, blank slate, we're going to change things, but we're not just going to do it overnight, as in, here's the budget, tomorrow that happens, or here's the budget, it happens in April. We're going to get there gradually. So, for example, if you go look at, you know, one of the pet complaints of this podcast, the 60% tax trap, right?
Mm.
Which basically means like highly productive people trying to do less work, cottage industry, and trying to earn less money. Okay. They earn lots of money. They're more than £100,000, but they're being taxed 60% on the chunk between £100,000 and £125,000 where the person allowance gets taken away. Lots of people agree this is a bad thing and it's economically negative. You say, okay, we can't get rid of that overnight. You could get rid of it overnight and it would probably be positive, but you go, okay, we're going to work towards getting rid of it. You do the same with the child benefit thing, the student loan stuff as well. I mean, the level of tax that some grads are paying, if you basically look at their student loan repayments as effectively a tax on their income, the sort of, you know, the marginal rate that they're paying compared to somebody who didn't go to university is sky high. And you go, okay, we're going to gradually do something about that. And that then gets rid of some of the fears of the kind of Liz Truss Kwasi Kwarteng mini budget moment, where all of a sudden you make all these dramatic changes and international bond investors, institutional bond investors freak out a bit and say, well, you're gonna have to pay us more money to lend to you. There were concerns about this with the budget. We've had a number of wobbles this year as well. You take away some of that because you go, look, this is where we're trying to get to. And the other thing I think we need to do in terms of that is we're way too reliant on this whole government borrowing thing, because our government borrowing is so big. And so we're doing policy by spreadsheet, we're trying to hit the numbers, tick the boxes, and we've backed ourselves into a corner with that because we've got to keep doing it, because if we suddenly say we're not going to do it, then all of a sudden investors are going to go, oh no, we're going to demand a higher yield to hold those gilts. But we've got lots of people in this country with quite a lot of money who want a return on their money. Let's tap them up. Let's say, instead of, like, you know, issuing debt to big investors, to gilts, you know, to buy into, which, you know, you can buy as a retail investor as well. And actually, they're very popular amongst retail investors. Look at that and go, hang on a minute. There's all these normal investors going out and buying long-dated gilts. Why don't we just issue some that are only for, you know, people in the country, pays them a guaranteed income, ideal for people in retirement, guaranteed income backed by the state, and then you put an inheritance tax break on it. And it says, you know, you invest £1,000 in these bonds and you hold them for longer than a certain amount of time, they become inheritance tax free. So, you know, it solves two problems in one go. And you tap, instead of trying to like take the wealth off people through taxes, you tap into that wealth and say, look, lend it to us, we'll make the country better.
Indeed, Simon, indeed. I want to talk in more detail about the sort of environment, the economic environment that we are living in at the moment, which includes housing market, interest rates have continued to fall, inflation has remained off target. Overall, what is the picture? I mean, you sort of say it's gloom and doom, but overall, let's look at interest rates. Why have they been falling if inflation hasn't really moved a huge amount? Explain.
Because the Bank of England's rate setting policy, the Monetary Policy Committee, is looking at what it thinks will happen to inflation in the future. So the inflation number that we look at is backwards looking. That's how prices have changed since a year ago. What the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee is considering is what it thinks is going to happen to that inflation number, how prices are going to change a year ahead, 2 years ahead, 3 years ahead. The further out that you get, the harder it becomes to predict this kind of thing, and the wider the potential path becomes, the closer you are in time, the closer they think they can be in terms of accuracy. So they're looking at inflation coming down, that they always said it was going to peak this year around about September-ish time, and there was a number of factors involved there. There was some stuff to do with energy prices, there was food prices, there was other things like that, but then that they thought it was going to start coming down. And that doesn't mean that life is getting cheaper, unfortunately. It just means that it's getting more expensive slower. This has enabled the Bank of England to cut interest rates. And we've seen a whole 1 percentage point, or 1% to normal people, taken off the Bank of England base rate. And we're now down to 3.75%. That's the lowest it's been in since 2023, when it was on its way up. And this is good news for mortgage borrowers. It's good news for businesses. It brings down borrowing costs. It should stimulate the economy, because by making the cost of borrowing money cheaper, you theoretically increase demand to do so. And that enables more businesses, more consumers, more mortgage borrowers to borrow money and then go out and do something with that money. But the Bank of England's not looking at economic growth. It's the MPC's mandate is inflation target 2%. Inflation has been stickier than we thought. I think something that is in rate setters' minds is the fact that they got caught out by the cost of living spike. I think it's in rate setters' minds around the world. They got caught out by the cost of living spike, and they don't want to get caught out again. So I think there is a degree of caution from the Bank of England, from the Federal Reserve, less so from the ECB, but there is still a degree of caution. And so they don't want to go all guns blazing, aggressively cutting. There are expectations that it will be cut maybe one time more or two times more next year. And then that's probably going to be, barring some kind of, you know, major financial incident,
that's going to potentially be it. There are some people suggesting we might get a recession next year. That could encourage the Bank of England to cut rates by more. But the Bank of England won't necessarily cut rates by more if inflation is still proving to be sticky, even if we do go into a recession. But in theory, the rate cutting bit of a cycle is good news for the economy and tends to stimulate the economy. And the US is in the rate cutting bit of the cycle as well. So that should be good for the global economy. Inflation is coming down. You know, 3% isn't too bad. Growth has been a bit meh, better in the first half of the year, not so good in the second half of the year. But next year could be better. You know, as I said, some people are suggesting there could be a recession. Maybe not. I think if you listen to businesses, then it doesn't look great. But actually, the consumer looks reasonably good. Mortgage cuts stimulating the housing market a bit, which has been in the doldrums this year. Quite often, after a year in which the property market's been in the doldrums, it suddenly picks up the next year. It can surprise you, as we found out during COVID. And I think there's every chance that, you know, next year could actually be way better than people think. And we might not be in such a bad position. And also maybe, just maybe, we might have put all of this kind of tax rise stuff finally to bed. And actually, tax receipts are pretty good. So if tax receipts hold up pretty well, government borrowing costs come down, we ditch a bit of the doom and gloom, then next year could potentially be really positive.
Do you know what makes me think of a quote? Is it Hamlet? I don't know. There is nothing good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. And we're going to be talking about investing in a minute, but so much of this is down to sentiment. If we believe things are rubbish, then it feeds on itself. So yes, Simon, hurrah for a bit of positivity. This was the year, talking of mortgage rates, where a lot of people came off those ultra low, alas, not me, because I never had one, ultra low rates. Did we see a little bit of a wobble with people having to pay a lot more money, or have we weathered that particular financial storm as well?
We've weathered that particular financial storm much better than most people thought we were going to weather that particular financial storm. If you think about it, people are suddenly facing, in many cases, hundreds of pounds more on their mortgage every month. And that is a large amount of extra money to be paying, especially at a time when, you know, lots of other costs have continued to be going up as well. And actually, people appear to have just swallowed it. It's seriously detrimental to people's financial position in terms of, A, you know, it's going to be making a difference to how they live. They might be having to cut back on as many luxuries as possible. With, you know, all that chat about the insane cost of going to a Wagamama or a Pizza Express, it's like, there's going to be a lot of middle class families who are not going to Wagamama or Pizza Express very often anymore. It's going to be having a really detrimental impact on people's ability to save money and to invest money. Because the money that they would have otherwise been potentially saving each month is going on, you know, covering the extra cost of the mortgage. And that's created a buffer that's meant they haven't ended up in financial difficulty due to their mortgage costs going up. But the flip side of that is it now means they can't save any money. Hopefully, most of those people are still automating all their money into their pension every month for employment and so on. It's definitely a big problem for people who are self-employed and don't have the reliable monthly income coming in. I had one of those very ultra low mortgage rates. I had a 1.4% 5-year fix, and we came off it in September and went on to a rate of just below 4%, which is good. Like, you know, we got below the 4% mark. But our mortgage is £500 a month more expensive.
What?
It's a big dent. That makes a really big difference as to what you can do. You know, each month. And I'm not complaining. I'm not on the breadline. I'm still have a very, very nice life. But it's a big, big difference between what we can do as a family, like the money that I could potentially save every month and so on. And overall, that does have an impact and will be acting as a major brake on the economy. There's still, UK Finance reckons, 1.9 million people who need to remortgage next year. The question is how many of them are going to be seeing rates jump and how many of them are going to be seeing rates go down. Because if they took out a mortgage 5 years ago, they took it out in 2021 when rates were still super low. If they took out a mortgage 2 years ago, they took it out in 2023 when rates were considerably higher. So you might get a sort of balancing effect whereby actually the losers are getting hit
but the winners are getting a bit more money. You know, so for the economy, there'll be a bit of a seesaw going on. So it's not necessarily as bad as it is, but we aren't out of the woods completely on this one yet.
No, indeed. Right, I did promise investing, that thing the government is desperate to get us to do more of. It's been a strong year for the FTSE, hasn't it? Volatile one for AI-linked stocks and a standout run for gold as uncertainty lingered, though. But Simon, use one word to sum up the year in investing.
Great. The FTSE is up, as we record this, 19.5% this year, the FTSE 100. That's a really great year. The S&P 500, which is, you know, the major US stock market, the US stock market makes up 60-70% of the world stock market. So, you know, it's the barometer for that. It's up 18% this year. That's a fantastic return. Mm-hmm. But it's been a roller coaster ride along the way. If you'd have said to people, after Donald Trump announced his tariffs early April and markets were absolutely crashing and he still wasn't backing down, this would turn out to be that kind of year for investors, they'd have called you a lunatic. But it's turned out that markets rebounded really hard after that. Trump eventually did back down. We had one of the shortest major corrections seen ever. And actually, interestingly, corrections have become a lot shorter. Even the COVID crash was quite quick. Markets got back to the level, you know, surprisingly fast after COVID, considering what happened. And so it's been led by, you know, big US tech stocks, the AI giants. There's worries over an AI bubble. There is certainly some big red flags going on. Some of the circular deals and stuff like that. Some of the companies that saw their value rocket and then in some cases sink again. Oracle, I think, is the one to watch here. But then some of those other companies are making money hand over fist. Nvidia, for example, is hugely profitable, but it announced blockbuster results and then has actually seen its shares fall since, which illustrates the danger when companies are priced for perfection, is you can deliver almost perfect results and still potentially suffer after the event. But you can't say it's only the AI bubble, because look at the boring old FTSE with its lack of AI-driven tech giants. You know, it's done fantastically well. It's up nearly 20% in a year. So these are it's years like this that deliver a lot when it comes to the long-term returns of investing, because it's years like this when you want to be invested all through the year from the start to the finish, that you didn't bail out after the tariff wobble and then not get back in, and then you lost out, you know, because you then bought back in higher right at the peak in the summer when all of a sudden things were going really well again. And, you know, these are the years where over the long term, those figures that show investing in the stock market beats cash come, because cash returns are still pretty good. You get 4% on a savings account at the moment, which is pretty impressive seeing as the base rate is 3.75%. You get even more than that on a cash ISA. But the difference between that and your 20% return from the stock market is substantial. Now, what could happen is next year the market could fall 30%. And those are the years that dent your returns. But by being invested in the year where it went up 20%, if it does then fall 30%, you know, it's not so bad. Because you have to take the rough with the smooth and you end up getting more good years than you get bad years. But yeah, it's been a great year for investors if they've managed to stay the course.
Well, I was going to say, this is great for those who, you know, this is a year in a long previous time before and after. If you are entering, if you're new to investing, which the government is very keen, I was reading an article about what an interesting time for the government to want to get people investing when markets seem very high at the moment. But then we're seeing things like commodities like gold and silver also high because of the unpredictability of what's going on at the moment. An interesting time. Is it like one of those cases where you had to get a mortgage just as Liz Truss's mini budget blew up, or you unfortunately bought a house just before the financial crisis? Is the now one of those times where if you start investing, you're going in at a peak? Or is it just like, well, if you're investing, you've got years to go anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Just do it.
Potentially, it is one of those times. And I would recognize that if you are someone who is new to investing and has a large amount of money that you're considering investing. Mm. So the way to get around this is to drip feed money in. So if you've got a large sum, you invest it over a period of time. And then, you know, you could get really unlucky and you just invest it as the market stays absolutely at the same level. And then right after you've drip fed it all in, the market crashes. And I'm sorry, there's literally nothing I can suggest to protect you from that. But, you know, you could be investing as the market goes up, and therefore you're already making gains on the money that you've put in, but you're not putting your whole lump sum in and risking that sudden drop. Or you could end up with the market going down, but then because you're investing gradually, yes, you're losing money on the money that you put in first, but you're buying in cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and eventually the market will get to the bottom and it will go back up. I would say if you are new to investing, regular investing is the thing to do. Put in a bit of a lump sum if you want to, but then do some regular investing and then just think very long term. It's not a 1 year game. It's not a 2 year game. It's not even a 5 year game. It's a 10 year game or longer. And so don't invest money that you cannot afford to have in full in the short term if you need it.
It comes down to education, though, doesn't it, Simon? I mean, I mentioned earlier about the government desperate to get us investing. What solution did they have? This was the cutting, of course, of the cash ISA limit. The danger is, I suppose, a lot of people don't invest. I mean, there's lots of reasons. Maybe there's a certain age where it's not sensible to, but lots of people don't invest because they don't think it's too risky. You then enter a market, it falls, as you said. I mean, we don't know it's going to fall 30%, but let's say it does. And then you think, that's exactly the reason that I didn't do it in the first place. And then you don't do it again. So eyes wide open, I think, when you go in this, and education, I think, needs to come as a sweet from, well, whoever, the government or businesses, whatever, to get people investing, but with knowledge.
And I would agree. And there is a lot, you get a lot of comments like that. Well, you know, I'm only going to lose money. People do things they lose money on all the time, though. People are happy to go out and buy cars. You're guaranteed to lose 30% on most cars that you buy in a couple of years. And that is the equivalent of some of the largest stock market crashes that we will see. And if you buy that car and you lose 30% on it in 2 years, I promise you, you will have to wait much, much longer for it to ever regain its original value than you will if you invest in the stock market and it falls 30% in the first 2 years. You have to wait a really long time and spend a lot of money on maintenance for that car to ever become a classic that regains its original value. So maybe think about that. I do think, sorry to put a little bit of negativity into the conversation again, but on the point of not listening, this is a classic example. The government has spent quite a lot of time coming up with its "we want to get in people investing" plans, and the "we want to get people investing" plans predate this government. This government, in theory, engaged the investment and savings industry on this question and consulted them as to what they should do. Overwhelmingly, the investment and savings industry said cutting cash ISA is not the answer. Even if it does make a few people invest more money, they won't invest it in the UK stock market. They'll probably just buy into big US companies. I don't think the British ISA was a particularly great idea, but it was a better answer than this. And the government completely ignored what people who actually know what they're talking about in terms of personal investment and savings said to them. And some of the people saying don't do this literally would have benefited in theory from this. You have people running investment platforms that don't even offer cash ISAs saying don't cut the cash ISA, it's not going to make people invest. You have people running investment platforms that do offer cash ISAs saying, actually, do you know what? We do get people in with cash ISAs, and then we try to convert them to become investors because we want them to, like, you know, use the other part of our business and use the cash ISA as like the gateway drug kind of thing. Get them in. It's the bit people understand. Then sell them the investing there. So don't cut the cash ISA. I had it described to me by one very, very senior person in the investment platform industry the other week as it wasn't a consultation. They just kept telling us what they wanted to do and then saying, can you do it? So they didn't listen at all. And they've just created a lot of bad headlines off the back of cutting the cash ISA. And it's not going to get people investing at all. Maybe some of the other stuff that they're about to do in the new year will, but The cash ISA cup is completely pointless. It's taken us back to a position that we got rid of, where there used to be different cash and investing ISA allowances. We got rid of that because it didn't work and it was a bad idea, and we've just gone backwards. And we completely ignored all of the people who know what they're talking about, who said, don't do this.
I sense that's an unfortunate theme at the moment, but there's always next year to reverse our course. Anyway, Simon, you almost beautifully teed me up and then you went talking about going off course. You went off course. You mentioned cars. It was a beautiful segue to my next story. And then you didn't talk about cars anymore. So I'm going to bring cars back, because this is a personal finance and consumer podcast. So I want to talk about one, the big, I suppose, consumer story of the year. It wasn't quite PPI, was it? But still a £1 billion headache for lenders. The car finance scandal compensation palaver. It still rumbles on. There was a story in This Is Money about it a couple of weeks ago. Where are we at? Pricey. I mean, I never got anything from PPI. I certainly wouldn't have got anything from the car finance, because I just buy things outright. Where are we now?
Well, we are on our way to getting it sorted, I would argue. The car finance thing comes from this huge boom in people buying cars through finance agreements, usually PCP deals, where effectively what you're doing is you're paying off the depreciation of the car over 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and then you have the opportunity to buy it at the end. And unsurprisingly, some of the people working for car dealers were loading the system to their own end. They weren't giving people buying cars a fair deal. Who would have thought it? Car dealers, not entirely trustworthy when it comes to financial stuff and trying to just make money wherever they could. Anyway, this was a huge industry backed by some very, very large lenders. It all blew up. People felt they'd been missold. There was talk about, you know, a PPI on wheels type thing where everybody was going to start reclaiming. The FCA stepped in. The FCA outlined what it was going to do about it, who was going to be able to claim. It is in the process of bringing in a system for people to claim. If you do think you're a missold car finance, don't sign up to someone promising to get it back for you, to one of these no win, no fee firms. Do it through the FCA. Then you will get the money yourself. The FCA, you know, estimates people are going to start getting these payouts over the next couple of years. The motor industry is still unhappy about it. The banking industry is still unhappy about it. There's still some debate as to whether the FCA scheme is going to come in the form that the FCA has outlined it. And we will know that probably in the next few months.
All right, then. Finally, your stat of the year.
39%. First-time buyers made up 39% of property sales this year, according to Zoopla, which is up from 35% the year before, and also is above the 25-year average. So that is actually a good figure. That shows that we are getting more people onto the housing ladder. It does also reflect the fact that the rest of the housing market has been somewhat moribund and there's less people moving home. But, you know, the fact that more first-time buyers are managing to buy is a good thing, because at the moment, in theory, house prices are going up by less than inflation and people's wages are going up by more than house prices. And so despite mortgage rates being high, homes are theoretically getting cheaper, and that is reflected in first-time buyers. And that is a sign of health in the economy.
There we go. A nice positive note to end on. That's it for 2025. You can keep up with all the latest breaking money news in 2026 and beyond. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. I hope that you all had a wonderful Christmas. I hope that you have a very happy new year. All credit to Georgie, who, when we were debating whether we should do a podcast this week or whether we should take a Christmas week off, was like, no, we need to do a podcast. We're doing a podcast. So there you go. We've done you a special Christmas week podcast. Yeah. You've had to listen to the two of us ramble on. Normal service will be resumed next week. But if you have any questions for us, what do you want to know about money? What's your question? What do you want us to look into? What do you want us to talk about? What do you want to tell us about the podcast? What do you want us to do differently? What do you want us to do more of? Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. And finally, we really, really, really appreciate you listening. We love all the messages that we get from you saying that you enjoy listening to the podcast. We love doing the podcast, and thank you for listening in 2025.
I mean, there's not much to add to that, Simon, but to say thank you very much. Have a very happy new year. And Simon, I think it was a bit of exuberance from both of us yesterday in our inability, I think, to judge our time management very well, that we thought that this was a very good idea. But I'm glad we did. It was good to speak to you today, Simon. Good to speak to you every week. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. And if you do like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.